stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Thank you for coming this morning, and do introductions first. On my far right, Heidi Harris, Taylor, California, Bill Massey, Forestville, Jeff Hales, John Corbett, McKinleyville, Mike Dunker.
Riodale.
And Bob, if you'd introduce yourself and staff.
Sure. My name's Robert Clampt. I'm the executive officer. To my right is Luis Rivera, our assistant executive officer. Legal counsel Samantha Olson. Legal counsel Kim Niemeyer. And then over on the other wall, we have Gene Lockett and Marty McKenna and Drew Bayless helping out with recording and that sort of stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Do we have any ex parte communication?
Yes.
Mr. Corbett?
Yes, I had a meeting with the Farm Bureau concerning the sediment amendment. There were a large number of questions about the process and where we were. There was confusion of where there was an interpretation that the sediment amendment would be a substitute for the 303D impaired watershed TMDL process. And so that's something in our staff comments we really need to spell out that relationship. There were a lot of questions about, is the work plan an independent regulatory document or a work plan? And so we need to, again, provide real clear guidance on the nature of the work plan. And generally just trying to clarify what the process is that's envisioned by the board.
Okay. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
Two weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C., looking for money for sewer systems for the West County and working on behalf of California Rural Water in the process on the airplane coming home. David Bischel, the president of California Forestry, was on the same aircraft, and we had a chance to talk. There was absolutely nothing pending or impending, but we were in a public place together.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Harris.
I was also at the meeting with Mr. Corbett at the Farm Bureau and discussed some just open conversation, very general, and touched on the same things that John was involved in.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I met Mr. Mark Lovelace, Humboldt Watershed Council, and former staff member Dave Kuzmar to discuss, to review a presentation that was previously given to this board in June or July of 2006 for elk and freshwater river. He's going to be giving he'll be speaking today, and this was just in advance of that, just for some background information. And again, it was just information that had been already presented to this board.
Okay, thank you. All right, take up the next item, which is a resolution delegating certain powers and duties to the executive officer. Board item, any comments?
Move approval, Mr. Chair.
Second.
Any comment? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. I'm pleased to have with us this morning Charlie Hoppen, State Board. Charlie, you want to make any comment?
Bob, I can tell you it's nice to be in a rural community coming from one. I'm usually talking to people from Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco that often have different values than I do. It always strikes me when you start your meetings and you discuss the ex parte conversations you have. I think as a state board member, we come under the same restrictions, and I understand why we have limitations on ex parte conversations, but looking at you and at other regional boards, people wouldn't be sitting in those seats if they weren't sincere about what they did, and it's often difficult for us to make decisions and gather knowledge in a vacuum, but I suppose as long as we go to the confessional once a month and tell everybody that we've talked to somebody, it's all right. But I sincerely want to thank all of you for taking the time that you take for the service you provide. People coming from a regional community, taking care of regional issues, certainly helps with the continuity of what we have to do at the state, and I sincerely appreciate that. I want to mention another of my frustrations, if you will, and that's some of the legislative mandates that we all have to deal with. And I should probably be turning around speaking to the audience on this, because so often things that come out of the legislature that either the state board or the regional boards are mandated to implement seem very draconian and very backwards. I think a lot of times when the legislature does what they do, they make laws, it sounds good, and by the time our engineers and staff have compiled something that resembles the mandate of the legislation, it's so draconian that people don't know what in the world to do with it, whether it's the mandatory minimum penalties we all struggle with, where I know up in this area you're briefly touched with AB 2121. I know these were all well-intended bodies of legislation. I could go on for hours about them, but I hope that all of your constituents will have patience with you as they have patience with us as we try and struggle through to do the right thing and not ignore the legislative mandates we have, but try to apply them in such a way that economies continue on and the environment can benefit in all the right things. And it's easy to say, but often it's a very difficult line to walk. And I certainly appreciate all your help, and I hope the people here realize that you're doing your very best. And sometimes we have one hand tied behind us and the other one behind our head. So thank you for having me here, and it's nice to be in a rural community. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. And we thank you for your service, too. It's as much fun as we have. We know you share. So. All right. We'll go on to the public forum. Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, if we might at this time take an opportunity to present an update on the freshwater spill as well as the ongoing spill on the Smith River, if that would be appropriate at this time?
I think it would in terms of...
Okay, Mr. Evans would make that presentation.
While they're doing a logistics thing out, we just say on behalf of the board, we thank you, Bob, for stepping into the big shoes and filling them on an interim basis. It's certainly a difficult task to try to keep this group all together moving forward, and it's been done without a hiccup.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
In response, I really appreciate the board's support. You have all been wonderful. It's been a fantastic experience for me. It's been a really good growth experience. I very much appreciated the opportunity, and thank you again for your support.
And you survived the fire hose.
Good morning. My name is Dave Evans. I'm a supervising engineer in charge of our groundwater cleanups program. And in December of 2007, we gave a status report to the board that had to do with response to a spill incident when a truck that fuels logging equipment went off the roadway and crashed into Freshwater Creek, spilling an estimated 100 to 200 gallons of diesel and some other petroleum products into the creek. The report that was given to you was by Luis Rivera. I was out of the office the last week of November and the entire month of December on a medical leave, and so I'm putting together this report, having reviewed the record, reading the reports, and interviewing the people that were involved, basically in my capacity as the chief of the groundwater cleanups division. The incident happened in the evening on November 28th. The emergency response personnel were immediately notified and mobilized to the site. Reverse 911 calls were made by the Humboldt County Health Department to let all downstream water users know that there was diesel in the creek and they needed to be provided with alternative water supplies. North Coast Environmental Construction is a cleanup company that was hired by the discharger, Steve Wills Trucking. the responsible party, and they arrived on scene on November 28th, the night of the spill. They were able to deploy booms into the creek with sorbent pads behind them, which is a pretty typical technology for recovering oil that's been spilled into a surface water. By November 29th, the truck had been emptied of all of its fluids. Remember, this was a truck that brings fuel to remote locations on timberlands, so it carries a large quantity of fuel, a large quantity of lube oil, and also waste oil from doing oil changeouts on, you know, bulldozers and other kinds of equipment. Visible petroleum hydrocarbon was removed from the creek. Surface water samples were collected. On November 30th, within 2 days of the spill, we had a cleanup order that was issued as well as a monitoring and reporting program that was delivered to the responsible party. An environmental consultant was hired to oversee the cleanup efforts and the sampling efforts. The written report I've got to you indicates the limited level of hydrocarbons that were found in the creek. This report is missing the initial data, which was given to us in a handout that came on February 18th from the Humboldt Baykeeper Organization that indicates that there was a round of sampling that took place while the slug of oil was still being flushed through the system and while we were still working with the booms to remove floating product from the creek. We're not surprised by this data. We're aware of it. The worst concentrations that you're going to see in the surface water are generally immediately after the spill, and after that they become diluted, they become flushed, and they become removed when you deploy booms and absorbent pads in order to collect that water.
I want to apologize to you, but I did want to ask a point of clarification to staff. We have the cleanup and abatement order. Are any other enforcement actions contemplated? And then if they are, just how far we can get into any facts being heard today. That's my concern, so we're not prejudiced in the future.
What we're going to be disclosing to you today is the facts associated with the response so far with regards to any potential enforcement action. There may be a claim for costs arising out of this. Other than that, staff is not contemplating bringing to you an enforcement action related to this particular event.
Well, is the advice then that we should listen to it but not really make any conclusions of that?
Yeah.
Because that might be pending?
At this point in time, we're going to be this is being done not as an agenda item in which the board decision is expected at this point in time. So you won't be asked for any particular opinion on the facts that are going to be disclosed today.
If I could go back for a moment to the December board meeting, you know, the staff gave a presentation that was basically, you know, this is the status of the spill, and it's pretty much a good news report. But then there were four other people who came from the audience to take exception to that, and the board asked the staff to look into the matter and report back to them at the next meeting that was to be in Humboldt County, which is today.
I am not critical staff. I just want to make sure the board keeps its it acts properly, starting with myself.
Thank you. So on December 4th, a door-to-door survey was conducted, which completes a sensitive receptor survey to make sure that everybody in freshwater was aware of the fact that that there had been a spill, you know, in the drainage that they got the water from. On December 6th, there was some hydraulic washing of the bank to take, you know, soil that absorbed into the bank and release it to the creek so they could pick it up with the booms. It was basically tidying up the spill site itself. Between December 7th and 14th, there were daily inspections were made of the booms. On the 14th, 2007, all the booms were removed because there was no further visual evidence of oil sheen in the creek. And this was done by the oil prevention and spill response people from OSPR at Fish and Game. During the course of this process, in the course of collecting samplings, we did find another source of petroleum hydrocarbons in the form of a Humboldt County Corporation yard, and we are in the process of making them another cleanup site that'll be entered into our cost recovery program. It was in a separate location and unrelated to the truck accident, but it was something that we found in this bill and that we're going to be following up on. During the second week of December, a meeting was held in Humboldt County amongst the response agencies to basically discuss how did the response go, was there anything we wanted to do that was, you know, seriously different, anything we didn't do that we wanted to make sure we did before, and the consensus of the group was basically that it was a job well done. The notifications were timely, the response was timely, the abatement of the impacts on the creek was quick, the impacts were of short duration, and basically within a couple of weeks of the spill, just about everything that needed to be done, we think, was done. This use of a reverse 911 system by Humboldt County was the first time they ever tried it, and they pulled it off pretty much without a hitch. They've done it since. You know, 911 has to do with reporting an emergency to the authorities so that they can respond to it. Reverse 911 is when the authorities, you know, report to the people that could be impacted by it, you know, that their water supplies were in jeopardy and that they needed to take protective measures and stuff like that. And I think that worked out well. You know, to quote Brian Cox from the Humboldt Health Department, the cleanup was done efficiently with good cooperation from the responsible party. And I would concur with that. On December 12th, 2 weeks after the spill, the Humboldt County Health Department was able to declare that people could resume the use of their water systems with a couple of conditions like, you know, clean the mud and the silt out and some things like that. You know, be vigilant for if there's any other machines that may come by. Since then, we've gotten no complaint calls from relate to us from the Health Department or from the citizens out there. On the 24th of December, we rescinded the monitoring and reporting program. On the 11th of February, we got the final report that summarized all the cleanup activities. The next items before us is to rescind the cleanup and abatement order. And then following a 30-day public comment period, you know, we're going to issue a no further action letter from the executive officer. We basically think that this spill is done, and we're pretty comfortable with all the responsible agencies that responded to it. My evaluation of the spill effort for freshwater is therefore positive. It was timely and effective. My hat goes off to those personnel who spent the night of the 28th out there on the creek that watched the sun come up the next day. This was the Humboldt County Health Department, the Fish and Game Warden, the contractor, the discharger's representative, and even a representative from Palco spent the night in the field making sure that the booms were put up and samples were collected the next day and provisions were made to pull the truck out of the creek. The fire department's response was excellent. They were there at 2 o'clock in the morning like everybody else. They helped and were really critical as far as the initial notifications were concerned, and I think they're all to be complimented. Notification system work, our OES beeper beeped, and we were informed of this bill as we were supposed to. All the appropriate agencies were notified in a timely manner. Let's see. Some of the things that I've learned from this, and when I talk about the Smith River spill and then other spills, is that there's no substitute for getting a staff person out there on the ground to see it. Dealing with these things from a distance over the telephone is going to be inherently confusing, and that it is critical to get out there as soon as you can and make your assessment and to make your requirements known. Whenever we have spills, it should be just a matter of days before we have cleanup orders directing stuff to happen, because there are things that can happen in the immediate aftermath of a spill that are not always available after the spill has had a chance to disperse itself out into the environment. There are some limitations as to what we can do. We had some other spills this year that were things that we couldn't really do anything about. We had a crane fall off a lowboy into the Trinity River near Salyer, where Heidi lives, and landed in the water. We were able to get the tanks unloaded, but by the time they got them dragged on shore, they were full of water. The diesel that was in those tanks was down the river, and there was nothing we could do about it. We had another incident on the Eel River near Redway where a septic truck went off the road and splashed into the water, lost some sewage, lost some diesel. The health department did the reverse 911 calls, but there was nothing that we could really do to put out booms during high water flows, you know, in something like the Eel River. So there are some limitations to what we can do. And as far as staff, you know, we don't have access to the kind of heavy equipment, the cranes and things like that, that are going to be necessary to remove vehicles from the water. So basically, our role is to see that the responsible parties are required to do all the reasonable cleanup measures just as fast as they can, and to collect both water quality data and evidence in case we want to do, you know, a pollution case against responsible parties. In the case of fresh water, I think the response by Wells Trucking was good. I see no reason I would recommend an ACL. I do think it's appropriate for us to send them a bill for the staff hours incurred because of the spill that, you know, happened due to their truck going off of the road and into the creek. There was another issue of bridge safety that was brought up and I looked into, and I'm not convinced that there was something structurally unsound about the bridge over Freshwater Creek that caused the accident. I think it was more the vehicle went off the bridge. The bridge didn't fail. It does bring up the issue that we've got, you know, trucks carrying chemicals and fuels going across bridges that are not part of the county road system and not part of the state highway system, and that could be a problem, but I don't see that the regional board under Porter Cologne or any other authorities is in the bridge inspection business. So I acknowledge the fact that you know, bridge safety is an issue. I don't really have a program that I can recommend to you that we would take that on ourselves to ensure that all bridges are inspected by civil engineers and deemed to be safe to carry the loads of the vehicles that go across them. I think that that concludes my comments. There was also some input that we received that questioned whether we would be better equipped to respond to spills if we had a local presence. In other words, if we had a Eureka office with people that, you know, were here, could we have gotten to Freshwater sooner? Of course we could. Freshwater's right next to Eureka. It's a matter of, you know, 10 or 15 minutes to get from downtown up to where the spill site was. But we're in Santa Rosa. We've talked about, you know, satellite offices and the expense and the difficulties and the complications there are. If anything, spill response would be a reason to consider, you know, having a satellite office. We would be better served if we had less of a response time to any of these kinds of spills. I want to close by saying that I believe we've got a handout that Gene has passed out to the board that has to do with the Baykeeper's submittal that questions the fact that we didn't have the initial sample results in the EOSR for today's meeting. I would acknowledge that these sample results are part of the record. We acknowledge them. We don't refute them. And they basically tell us what we expected to see, that the highest levels were right after the oil got spilled and before any of it got removed or, you know, flushed through the system. And that concludes my report on freshwater. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you.
Question? As a result of this, do the agencies that are involved have a more efficient or an improved communications protocol? For example, if Agency A is the first to receive the call, do they now have everybody else's phone number to call them and say, hey, this is what happened? So just in terms of getting the word out to everybody that needs to be on scene.
I believe that you know, each of us have lists that we call. We have our own spill response folks in our office where we have lists of the, you know, various fire departments and the various health departments and who the contact people are. Of course, they have to be updated because personnel come and go and stuff like that. But the sort of the safety net for the whole thing is the Office of Emergency Services, because, you know, everybody who receives spill information or other emergency information phones that in, and they act as a clearinghouse. They have the list that they need to keep, you know, like up to date on. This was a Trinity County spill, so the fish and game person that needs to be responded is at such and such a phone number and stuff like that. And that's the one that's important, that it function properly, because it is the sort of safety net that the state has to make sure the notification is complete and timely.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunker.
One thought that came to my mind, only because I've lived in this area for a while and have been oil spill trained and responded to some larger spills and know of other programs around, I'd like to introduce the potential idea of looking at some sort of a merger, maybe with the Water Board and the Watershed Stewardship Program in this area as a potential link to having somebody up in this area through a program that already exists. I'm not sure exactly how to make it work, but I think it has a potential thought to at least to explore and could be a way of entering into some activity up here by the Water Board of people that, you know. Anyway.
All right. There's a group. Wait, before you answer that, the chair is interested in moving off this item with some aplomb because of
the time.
Many other items, and if we dig in too deeply at the beginning, I have to be at a meeting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning in Healdsburg, so,
moving right along.
Protect that time. But I am open to board member comments. You know, again, this was set up to give us enough. Initially, there was a report. It was kind of too early. We wanted to come back when we were next up here to hear a more in-depth report. Dave's given that. Happy to take, as Mike's saying, here's an idea, but I don't think we want to get into a discussion of how many staff should be positioned in Eureka at the moment.
No.
Mr. Chairman, to support that a little bit, I think we could just hope that staff will get back to us with a final report after there are no enforcement items on the table, and then we can comment and bore into the facts a little bit.
This won't be its last time here.
Right.
That said, any concluding
comments? Are there any speaker cards that you have?
There are.
Okay, then I will step aside and then come back and tell you about the Smith River, if I may.
Because we have Humboldt County or Humboldt Fire District. You want to speak? And I would try to say this, but Glenn Schumer.
Close.
And I'll submit to the record the handwriting on this card. But
I've been accused of being a wannabe physician, so that's certainly fair. My name is Glenn Zimmer. I'm the fire chief for Humboldt Fire District in Eureka, California. I just wanted to speak to you briefly in regards to the freshwater incident. I was contacted by your staff subsequent to the incident. We were the initial responding agency, and I was the incident commander of our response and the coordinated response of local government for about the first 6 hours. Subsequent to that conversation, I had the opportunity to listen to the audio file that existed of your December 4th meeting. And while I certainly stipulate the right of citizens to present an opinion, I was a little discouraged, quite frankly, with what I consider the candor of the comments. A couple of people characterized the response as atrocious, inappropriate. One alluded to the fact that there was, in fact, according to her allegation, no response for a period of over 12 hours. That makes for great street theater, but it doesn't jive with the real world situation very carefully. And so my comments today are not so much to defend the performance of local government agencies as to simply suggest to you that that characterization I think is highly inaccurate and generates from a motive that I won't even go to. Our agency responded to what we initially thought was actually an automobile accident based on the CHP 911 call that was initially received. We had two units on scene within 11 minutes, and they discovered, as you now know, a fuel truck laying on its side in Freshwater Creek. They did a quick evaluation of the personnel, who fortunately had only minor injuries, and then turned their attention to the immediate mitigation of the loss of product into the stream, which was apparent at the time of their response. For the next hour, essentially they used their on-site resources and resources that we stripped off of the local hazmat response vehicle to try to mitigate the initial loss of product by both containment, capture, and booming. The Willis people, who were also on scene, were directed to utilize resources that they had nearby to set up boom structures at the freshwater park, which is just immediately downstream from the spill location. County Environmental Health was on scene shortly. CHP representatives were on scene shortly. Within an hour, we had made state OES notifications and all the local notifications that were required, and had contained and tried to mitigate to the degree that the resources on scene allowed the circumstance. At that point in time, I made a determination that I thought the reverse 911 system that was referred to would be the most effective way to deal with the public information aspect of the incident. And so I initiated a reverse 911 call to a geographically defined area that basically consists of an overlay of the Freshwater Valley. The system basically automatically contacts parties in an identified GIS parameter, and we were able to make 232 phone calls, of which about 174 actually made contact with parties within that geographic area. So we felt we were reasonably effective at notifying the public within an hour of the spill that if they had domestic water supplies that were dependent on Freshwater Creek, they might want to try to isolate those. And that was our basic goal, as well as just generalized public information. The one aspect that I think probably, quite frankly, could use some improvement is we handled the first hour and a half, 2 hours of it very well with the available resources. Being a relatively isolated geographic area, we are essentially mandated by economic constraints to use private contractors for this kind of second-tier response that happens after the immediate emergency agency response. And quite frankly, that was a bumpy road. I went through, I can't tell you how many phone calls and contact agencies trying to get a hold of resources that we knew to be available in the local area that are privately held by a company called NRC. They actually had staff members in the area, just coincidentally, because they were doing another project at the PG&E power plant. But in a normal circumstance, accessing those private resources tends to be the very problematic part of the process because NRC is a private for-profit corporation. And when they meet you, they will introduce themselves and they will hand you a clipboard with the financial responsibility form. As a representative of a small public agency, I'm not going to sign one of those, period. That's just the way it is. And if you were taking this incident to Bridgeville or someplace even more remote where you have a local volunteer agency, I can't imagine a local volunteer fire chief that's willing to sign an NRC financial responsibility form to get access to resource materials. And to me, that's the Achilles heel of this whole process. I think if there's anything that the board could do to learn from this incident based on our experience, it would be that there needs to be the establishment of a very, very explicit and very express mechanism that would allow local emergency responders to access initial resources that could significantly affect the long-term outcome of these incidents. As your staff, I'm sure, will tell you, actions that you take in the first hour or so can have tremendous long-term effects, and from a financial risk-benefit perspective, can provide huge returns for relatively small initial investments. But there is no clean mechanism right now. I ended up talking to the Marine Safety Officer for the Coast Guard in San Francisco trying to get access to these secondary resource materials. So I'm not here, like I said, to defend our performance. I actually think it went very well. I think the first 6 hours of the incident were handled as well as they possibly could have been, and I think we were effective in a field way, in an operational way, and in a protecting the public interest perspective. So I just wanted to suggest to you that the characterization you heard at your December 4th meeting, I don't think it's factual, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Board member, questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you for your community service, sir.
All right, we may take up another time the suggestion of trying to figure out the mechanism you're discussing, so, but not right at the moment. We're done? Freshwater? Dave, we've had so much fun with one spill. You want to try a second one?
Unfortunately, in my mind, Freshwater was easy. The Smith River is going to be hard. On February 22nd, about 2:30 in the afternoon, a fuel truck crashed adjacent to the Smith River on Highway 199 between Gaski and Hiuchi, southbound into Crescent City. He was carrying 4,000 gallons of red diesel, and all of it was spilled into the roadside ditch. Fortunately, we had a highway patrol by who happened by within moments, and had also observed up the road a Caltrans backhoe working on a separate project, and turned around and went to the backhoe, commandeered the person who came immediately down the highway and plugged up the roadside ditch so that all 4,000 gallons of the diesel did not make it into a culvert and did not make it overland into the Smith River. Unfortunately, all of it sank into the ground at the roadside ditch. That Smith River Canyon is a rocky canyon. If you've been on it, it's a very windy road. It's a very dangerous road. If you look at the terrain down below, Well, this is the top of map that doesn't show up as well, but it's really steep. But down below, there are a lot of gravel bars that really are rocky, bouldery, strewn kind of gravel bars, which makes working with equipment very difficult. This is the spare location. That telephone pole is pretty close to where the truck actually crashed, and all those pads that are there in the ditch were put out to collect any of the surface diesel that hadn't sunk into the ground, but most of it had sunk into the ground within the first hour. One of the things that we're doing for corrective action is we got Caltrans in there with a backhoe. This terrain is basically, like I say, it's rocky, and then it goes underneath the road to an armored slope that's made of large boulders that I suspect are lava the blasting side cast when they dynamited the road back in the 1920s. And then below that is a gravel, boulder strewn river bar. So this is a very difficult place to work and a very difficult place to go extract and recover 4,000 gallons of diesel. This is looking down on the river bar with the river at a higher flow than it's been ever since the accident. They've got a yellow boom out there that's, so that anything that might have come out of the toe of the river bar would be collected so that they could use absorbent pads to cover it. The first deployment of the boom wasn't so good. Within a couple of days, they got a lot better booms out there. This is the only access down to the river bar. They got a crew of up to 40 people to go down there to dig trenches on the bar to intercept the floating diesel so that they could collect it with absorbent pads, put them in the plastic bags, and then haul them off. This little road pathway is still there today. It's the only way down. They did last week get a tracked excavator equipment down there due to the fact that they got an amazing operator who was able to use his bucket to steady himself as he worked on a very steep slope and got himself access down under the river bar. They potholed all over the place looking for floating diesel, and they found it. Where they found it, they put in pads. And then they decided to dig two rows of trenches, one at the bottom of the road prism at the beginning of the gravel bar, and then one of them adjacent to the river. This is one of the ditches being formed. The initial work was all done by hand, and you can see that some of these boulders are huge. And if you look to the right, you'll see that the scouring of the river as it goes up and down and floods sort of washes these rocks free of sands and smaller material. But once you dig down into it, you start getting into much more fine-grained material, sand and stuff like that, where the diesel can hang up. This is a little bit of an improvement as far as the booms on the edge of the river. Right now, I was out there yesterday, it's a bit more quiescent right there next to the booms, but there is a rapid that goes right by this place. There's been a couple of days when they've gone out there and actually seen visible sheen coming out on the river's edge, and there's been a couple of days where they've seen sheen in the ditch, the trench that they've dug that's 8 feet or so inland from the river. Otherwise, all the diesel we found has been pretty much confined to the potholes and the trenching that we have done along the slope of the highway embankment. But in certain cases, the river level went down. And when the river level goes down, the level of the groundwater and the gravel bar goes down, and then it goes below the surface of the trenches. Some of the earlier photos, the ones that I don't have available for you today, showed it looked like cherry Kool-Aid, because it's red dyed diesel that was in the truck, and they were able to sop up great quantities of that. We probably got many hundreds of gallons collected so far, but the fact of the matter is that there was 4,000 at large at the beginning of the spill. You can see some of the pink that's on one of the pads, looking down between some of the boulders. This is kind of typical. And again, this is what happens when the water level goes down. The pads are just sort of sitting on the bottom of the dry trench. They're not really doing anything. So my instruction to him yesterday was get that equipment back down on the bar and dig those things deeper. I want to see pink. I want to see diesel. I want to see it coming out of the hole. I'll get into some more of the cleanup technology stuff that we're talking about when I get done with these pictures. Hand crews, dig rocks, tough digging. This is the equipment that they finally got in to bring down to help them excavate, and pads being strewn all over the place. Okay, so we've got several areas of concern. One of them has to do with the source area up at the roadside ditch, because that's where the diesel oil went into the ground. They went and dug about 4 feet deep, width of a hole, with Caltrans permission, with some concerns that road safety was an issue, that they didn't want, you know, heavily loaded log trucks and cement trucks and stuff like that driving by an open ditch. But they left a lot of the source behind, and now they're going to go back with a round two, dig it deeper, down to 8 feet. They've got Caltrans engineers on board with it. We've got a cross-section by the engineers. They're probably going to get another 650 yards out of that roadside ditch, which will be helpful in terms of source removal. The only other thing else we've got is digging the trenches down below. They're coming up with a water treatment system. So that they can pump water out of those trenches, which should hydraulically pull the diesel towards those trenches, where they can use pads to get rid of the floating product and then just pumps to get rid of any high concentrated diesel that they've gotten in the bar. We've got 2 7,000-gallon tanks sitting up on a pull-out place on the side of the road. They're going to get augmented with a carbon treatment system and a resin system for removing the contaminants from the water. And then we have an issue of all the contaminated soils that are down on the river bow that have been in contact with the diesel. And we're working through a cleanup and abatement order that was issued last week and is being revised tomorrow, asking them for work plans on how they're going to do all this stuff. The response has been pretty good. The effectiveness has been not completely to my satisfaction. I'm worried that there's still an awful lot of diesel out there, and there's the only place for it to go is towards the river. We know it, the pathway is from the spill location to the river, because we've already seen sheen along the side of the river. And so what we have to do is insert capture capabilities between the diesel mass and the river and collect that stuff. And it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap.
With that, if I may interrupt, clarifying that this is a potential enforcement action before this board in the future. Thank you.
All right.
That concludes my comments. I'd be happy to take questions.
Board members have questions at this time?
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, I have another card, public comment on the Humboldt Bay Harbor District, Pat Higgins.
Actually, I'll wait until the freshwater and Elk Creek are discussed.
Oh, okay. Sorry. On the freshwater spill, we have other freshwater items. Reason for the chair's confusion. Doug Colbert, City of Ferndale. Update on their project.
Doug Colbert, City of Ferndale. Appreciate the time to update you. Since we last talked in December, at that time we had picked an alternative for our plan, and we have secured an engineering firm who has completed a 10% design for our new project. The 10% design of the old project had already been completed. We'd already reached that stage, but because of the change in alternative and project, we had to go that way again. We're moving forward with our CDO compliance and our amended timeline. We've got a lot of players that are involved in our projects in Ferndale that we've brought in, different engineering firms, different consulting firms, and we're working closely with them. A lot of people working together. Salt River Restoration Project is a big project that's happening there in Ferndale that will affect our project in many ways, positive and possibly negative. We've secured grant funding to help the city out with our I&I issues, which has been a major problem over the last many years that have caused us to have different overflow situations and high flow situations through our plant. So we're excited about that. We've got a $36,000 grant that we just secured that'll enable us to put some cameras in our system and look for leaks and cracks and debilitating situations. The city manager and myself have one of the biggest things that we're in the middle of now is securing funding for our wastewater project, and which is a big thing. I mean, we have a nearly $8.5 million project, and so we have gone through the USDA for their grants, the state revolving fund, and just many other options that we have available to us. And so a lot of our time is spent just filling out applications, submitting them, hoping they'll come back with something. And we're looking for any means that we can to do that with a small city that 12 months ago had $60 in our bank account. So we're happy that we've come out of that, but still, you know, it's an uphill battle, and we while it's not something that most people would look forward to, we look forward to the ability to do that and to get the funding. And the main reason for me sitting here today is because of our past issues that we've had in the city of Ferndale, and I'm sure you're all aware of what we've gone through over the last several years. We've stepped up our communication with the regional board staff and are in contact with them on a weekly basis. Sometimes more than that, but we like to keep them appraised of what we're doing, take input from them, so they know that we're serious. And we wanted to let the board know how serious the city is about resolving our wastewater issues in the city of Ferndale. And so that's why I'm here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. The chair is going to seek some direction from executive officer in terms of comments. I suspect it's wise to start in one place, but I'll see if he has any suggestions for us on Mark Lovelace's presentation.
I believe Mark has a PowerPoint presentation for you. We'll take about 15 minutes. And then we have other folks in the audience here. I've had a request from a couple of folks from Pacific Lumber Company who need to get down to Sacramento this afternoon for a conference. So if they could follow Mark. And then I imagine you have other speaker cards for residents.
Yeah, we have.
We have to get back to work.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I was hoping to speak while that topic was raised.
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay.
And, you know, the chair will wade into this with some hesitancy about, you know, we are in a public forum, and I have about a dozen cards all on this item, which is not an item. It's an interesting conundrum where we're stuck, people wanting to talk about an item that in public forum, and we're here to hear from the public at the same time. It's really, as I look down 12 cards, at all, they're not here to, so. Oh, suffice it to say that I understand Mark has a 15-minute presentation. I will attempt to rein that to 15 minutes, and then we will hear from other folks, and as the day progresses, I may rein harder. Because, you know, we do have other significant items. It is a possibility, as it's noted in the agenda, for the chair to decide that we've spent 30 minutes on public comment and then continue the public comment until the end of the meeting, which I will attempt to avoid going down that path, but if need be, we have other items.
Thank you, ma'am.
We're trying to move forward. I will say only that, you know, this is somewhat unusual and that this chair intends for it to be considerably unusual to have 15-minute presentations okay. as part of the public forum sessions. That's not your problem. You got 15.
Thank you. I'm Mark Lovelace with the Humboldt Watershed Council, and I appreciate you making this accommodation. As you recall, Pacific Lumber Company CEO George O'Brien came before you back in September, and the board allowed what became an unscheduled 30-minute discussion of the Tier 2 program at that time, including quite literally a nod towards staff to approve some additional enrollments in that program. This is an issue that's of great interest to the Humboldt Watershed Council. We've been involved in it for 10 years. And it's also of great interest to the affected downstream residents, many of whom are here to speak. And had that been a properly noticed discussion, we certainly would have been there at that time. Not having been aware that discussion was going to take place, we asked for this time and we appreciate that we've been given that opportunity. So the Tier 2 program really is something that we've never had the opportunity to have a full hearing on what exactly it is, on what its merits may or may not be, and on what the record is that supports this. So that's largely what we want to speak about here today. We believe that the Tier 2 program is fatally flawed, and simply because there's no basis for this program, period. I brought what I could quickly gather of the record that I have just since 2003 when I've been on board with the Humboldt Watershed Council. This is the record for the WWDR program, and it's not the record for the Tier 2 program. This is the record for the Tier 2 program. We've got a 10-year record to get to the WDR. We've got roughly a 10-word record to get to Tier 2. There's a little bit of an imbalance there. The program is not only not supported by the administrative record, but Tier 2 actually directly contradicts the scientific basis for the WDR. Due to that, we believe that it should be rescinded. Staff has actually has recognized that there's deficiencies in the monitoring and reporting program for the Tier 2. They've acknowledged the need to rescind and or revise the Tier 2 MRP, and yet that has not happened. And despite those shortcomings, staff has continued to enroll THPs in this program, and no changes have happened to it. We also believe that the program ultimately is a waste of staff's time, that, again, that it should be rescinded and that no further time should be put into this. The Tier 2 program is it's a staff-intensive, piecemeal, THP-by-THP approach to regulation, which is something that the WDR was supposed to get this board and the staff away from. Staff resources, the program provides no programmatic benefit. Each enrollment informs only that enrollment and provides no program with which to go forward. Staff resources that are spent on it don't get you any closer to the TMDL, and in fact divert staff away from the TMDL, which was always supposed to be the goal. The WDR was supposed to be an interim measure to get you towards the TMDL. The creation of this program has taken staff's focus away from that, away from cleanup abatement orders, and away from the real purpose of recovery in these watersheds. So this is the administrative record for the WDR. This was 8 years of meetings, hearings, studies, etc., and thousands of pages. I spent a lot of money on paper and document and folders and ended up having to buy bigger and bigger folders for this thing. Dozens of motions along the way, all guiding you and your staff towards one central premise that underlies the WDR, which is that harvest-related landslides cannot be adequately predicted. It can't be done. And thus, they cannot be prevented
if you can't predict with certainty where it is or is not going to landslide, then you can't prevent that landsliding from happening. The only way that you can regulate and control the sediment from harvest-related landsliding is to model that sediment as a function of the amount of harvest activity happening in the watershed. That is the premise of the WDR. That is what this record supports. This goes back to the September 9th, 2000 staff report, where they clarified that there is a causal relationship between timber harvesting, landsliding rates, and sediment yield from landsliding. This was a hard-fought point for took many years just to get to that. A handout that was given to the board during the approval process for the WDR points out that it's a significant uncontrolled source of sediment, that the recently harvested areas produce between 2 and 19 times more sediment than unharvested areas. It pointed out that the discharger, in proposing continuing harvest, that this will cause additional unavoidable sediment discharges from harvest-related landsliding. Unavoidable. The technical report for the landslide model discusses the use of all the same kinds of tools that are being applied to the Tier 2 program, this piecemeal approach of getting out there and trying to determine using mass wasting avoidance strategies or other similar strategies, and concluded that the effectiveness of these measures is largely unknown. The findings resolution for the WDR, item 73 in the approach identifies the rate of sediment production expected on forested acres and those expected from harvested acres, showing that there's a correlation between sediment production as a result of harvesting. And this is the key. Every acre in the watershed falls into one and only one of the land classes listed in the table. And for each harvested and unharvested, they have low hazard and high hazard zones. There is no zero hazard zone. It has never been mapped. It has never been defined how you would get there. And in practice, a Tier 2 program allows that zero hazard zones can actually include high hazard zones. They can include high to low shall stab values. They can include existing known unstable areas. There is no definition for a zero hazard zone. It has not been defined. Also from the resolution, the availability of best management practices for landsliding is speculative. Tier 2 program is based on speculation. It has never been proven. It has never been supported. Again, there is no way to determine that zero hazard zones exist. Ultimately, coming forward with this statement, the only available means of ensuring compliance with the limitation is to curtail timber harvesting activities in compliance with the receiving water limitation. This is the fundamental basis of the WDR. So we had this 8-year record for that, but where's the record for Tier 2? There is none. Again, there's this. This is the entire record for Tier 2. There's no scientific basis. In fact, this is the basis saying it can't be done. This is your record saying Tier 2 won't work. So the entire record was contained in just a few words that were inserted after this 10-year process, after many, many hearings, after hearings that had false starts and got appealed and stayed. And some of you remember how lengthy and difficult this process was. And at the end of that, literally a sentence got inserted saying that effectively, even though the whole record says it can't be done, if the executive officer believes it can be done, then go ahead and give it a try. That's the basis for Tier 2. That's about the extent of the science that goes into it, is give it a shot, see if it works. And in fact, in the findings resolution, the board even inserted that they're very dubious of the approach, saying the Regional Water Board is unaware of a monitoring method that will enable compliance to be determined on an ongoing basis. So even though you allowed with that sentence that, if you want to give it a try, maybe, you put in there that we don't think it can be done. We're not aware of any method that will allow it to be done. So Tier 2 is fatally flawed. There's no basis whatsoever. There's no mapping for the zero risk areas. There's no criteria for zero risk areas. And there's no reproducible criteria of any kind. This is a THP by THP piecemeal approach. It doesn't create a basis upon which to go forward. Again, these permits stand in opposition. The whole approach is directly opposed by the very foundation of the WDR. It's never had a public hearing before the board. This has been punted to the executive officer, which has denied both the board and, more importantly, the public any opportunity to review the program, any opportunity to provide scientific counterpoint to it. Let me just move on. So what's happened under the Tier 2 program? Well, you can see laid out in the years since it was approved, the allowance in freshwater watershed was under the WDR was for 144 acres of harvest. And the allowance, and that's what was backed up. That amount of harvest was backed up by this record. This huge 10-year record said, this is all we can allow you to do. Beyond that, we don't think we're going to get recovery in this watershed. The Tier 2 program, with no basis, no science, no review, allowed at times even more harvest than under the WDR, basically doubling in those years the amount of harvest with no basis to it. It took 10 years to get to, again, 10 years to get to the WDR. And by inclusion of this, and that was the limit, was 144. And by inclusion of that one sentence, it's allowed for doubling that limit. So again, we believe that it must be rescinded. Staff has already recognized the deficiencies, recognized the need to rescind or revise, and yet those enrollments have continued to happen. In November of 2006, when the MRP for the Tier 2 program first came together, we came before the board asking for you to reconsider that, reconsider the MRP program, and that did not succeed. Following that, we had discussions with staff. We had a meeting in Benbow where, with staff and with Adrian Miller of PALCO, where presumably we were supposed to have an opportunity to see the scrutiny that was going into this thing and understand that, wow, there's some really good science here. And that's where we learned that zero hazard could include high hazard, could include existing landslides, could include high and low shallstab values, could include anything. Anything whatsoever could be called a zero hazard area. Following that, we provided comments to staff on the deficiencies that we saw in the program. I've provided a copy of those comments to all of you. Later, we had a meeting in Willits with Mr. Corbett and the staff, and that was followed by a meeting that they had with Pacific Lumber Company, we understand. Following upon that meeting, following upon continued input, we had communication from the executive officer that we're beginning work on modifying the monitoring and reporting program now. That was in June. A week later, we were told by Mr. Neely that Mr. Neely is doing some significant rewrites to the MRP and to the enrollment criteria. In July, we were told that the MRP revocation letter will follow soon, that it was in staff counsel's hands. And then we're told after that that the latest strategy is not to revoke the MRP, but to revise it and supersede it later, and that it was proposed that a draft would be issued in October to this. None of these things have come to pass. There has been no change to this program. It has not been revoked. Permits continue to be issued, despite staff's admission that it's a flawed program. Again, here's the flaws, as we talked about. There's no mapping. There's no definition for the concept of zero hazard. That PALCO's own enrollments have listed categories from A to D, determining the risk factor. And you would think that that zero hazard could only be a subset of the lowest hazard rating, but that has not been the case in any of these scales that we've looked at. Again, it's a fatally flawed program. It has no basis in science. It stands in direct opposition to the massive record underlying the WDR program. It must be rescinded. Staff has acknowledged this. We don't believe that it needs to be rescinded and revised. We think it just needs to be rescinded and put away, just put to bed. It was a bad idea to start with. that's ineffective. I believe you'll hear from residents that the recovery, that this whole program, that the WDR program was supposed to bring about, is not happening, and in fact, the sediment deposition continues to get worse in these watersheds. So how can you justify allowing yet more harvesting on top of the WDR? Again, it's a waste of staff's time. It gets you no further towards CAOs and to the TMDL, which was supposed to be the long-term goal in this process all along. So thank you for your time, and we would hope that that this could result in some action, some direction. We appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask two brief questions?
You may.
One is, the independent science panel suggested that roads were a component of the problem, and the watershed-wide permit is primarily occupied with the intensity of harvest. What do you think is the status and relationships of roads to the issues in Elk and Freshwater? Just very briefly, do you think it's a significant issue, insignificant?
Well, I think that roads have been defined out of the equation to where landsliding, harvest-related landsliding that happens to be pertinent to a road is defined as not harvest-related, it's road-related. And so we've defined, we went through this in November of 06, how the direction that they needed to produce, that no additional sediment was turned into no additional sediment from harvest-related landsliding, and then harvest-related landsliding got defined away to discount anything that has anything to do with anything other than the actual harvest area itself. And so we've defined this away. It's very similar to what's happened with poverty, where you say, you know, poverty's going down because we lowered the poverty line. We've done that. Sediment's going, you know, sediment from landsliding is going down because we've reduced what can be called sediment from landsliding. So I think that that's a problem. Plus, the ISRP fundamentally supported the concept behind the WDR that you can't adequately predict where it's going to landslide, and you can't adequately avoid it.
Okay. The second quick issue is, when we had a site tour of the regional board, the former director of the California Department of Forestry, Dr. Tuttle, had pointed out a log jam. And without ascribing the status of that and a cure of that to the many, many problems in the watershed, do you know, is the logjam still there? And if not, what the status is? And if someone else in the audience knows that.
I believe residents in the audience would be able to answer that better. But I would point out that that logjam exists independently of whether you're continuing to permit harvesting under a process that has no basis.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm trying to get more comprehensive than only the existing permit, which only regulates the intensity of harvest. And I think there's a lot of issues in that watershed that will have to be addressed. So that's...
Any additional questions?
Anybody? Thank you. Appreciate your concluding within your time. Appreciate that. Again, I've got 10 or 12 cards. Pat Higgins, followed by Jeanette Junkers.
I've got handouts for the board, if that is okay.
And again, at this point,
3 minutes.
3 minutes.
And I don't have cards for everyone, but some of you know me. My name is Pat Higgins. I'm a member of the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District. I'm also a consulting fisheries biologist with 20 years' experience in the Freshwater Creek watershed. And so I'm going to do 20 years of experience in 3 minutes. And so fasten your seatbelt.
Thanks so much for your technical assistance. Quotes from the Humboldt Times and the Humboldt Standard. When everywhere you looked in Humboldt Bay, there was fish in the air. In these creeks, you could go in and catch several hundred what they call trout, which were probably cutthroat and juvenile steelhead, in a day. And the fishing was good through 1941. And as a matter of fact, I can personally testify that you could go watch and catch leaping coho salmon in 1988 in the Elk River Estuary, and it was probably the best coho salmon fishing in the state. Healthy watersheds filter sediments, store water, and give you base flows throughout summer, cold water that these fish have co-evolved with. When you alter the hydrology of a watershed, such as Freshwater Creek, you'll note that there are online addresses. If you guys want to do more homework on the stuff that I'm conveying to you, this is all readily accessible online. I did the descending report on the Palco Wa, on the fisheries module, and there's clear association of logging and roads and water quality problems. Here's a shot of the Upper Elk River. And logging has exceeded about 80% in some sub-basins within the Elk and freshwater watersheds, and I would suggest that 25% in 30 years is a prudent risk limit. And there's science from Reeves et al. To support that from Oregon studies. Road densities are extremely injurious to fish because they change the hydrology and yield sediment. And while 2 miles per square mile is prudent risk, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, these watersheds have 4 to 10 miles per square mile, and that doesn't include skid trails and temporary roads. And the result, and here's your harvest levels through 2002 in Freshwater Creek, so you can see there's a very extensive and what I would call over-prudent risk levels for sure. Here's Graham Gulch in winter, and you can see it's very, very turbid. And then you see the same condition, not the same condition in summer. You see no base flow. So you see a trend in spawners in Graham Gulch from where you had 80 fish, rather. And then in the late 1990s, there are no fish. Fine sediment, if you've got clean gravels, it's optimal for insect production and salmon. As you get up above 30%, the emergence and survival goes down dramatically. And in fact, freshwater, all the stations measured in 1988 were healthy for salmonids, and by 1999, they had doubled or tripled, very injurious to salmon and steelhead. Elk River, similarly, the baseline conditions are at left, Little South Fork Elk River, sand-sized particles, 60% sand bed in the North Fork, not conducive to salmonid production. Turbidity, loss of pools, increased fine sediment, increased flood risk, and greatly reduced fish populations, both in elk and freshwater. There's a picture of a spawning coho in your that I've circulated to you, and you can see the conditions are adverse. That's 1998. There's no data for Elk River. Freshwater turbidity, over what they call 25 nephelometric turbidity units, tongue twister, steelhead can't find lunch. And there you see for months at a time in Freshwater Creek, in the Elk River, and actually Eel River right outside the door here, there's months when these fish can't grow, and they spend 2 or 3 years in freshwater, and that is injurious also to the coho. And bugs, fish eat bugs. 1994, at just above the South Fork freshwater, you had 21 species of mayflies, stoneflies, and caddis. They're pollution intolerant. And by 1997, you had 12 species. This plummeting is directly related to the sediment. So what's the take home? Reduce harvest rate to allow watershed recovery, reduce road densities and road crossings, reduce activities on unstable slopes, make sure default riparian buffers from the HCP are maintained. And, you know, as a Harbor District member, it costs a lot to dredge the sediment of out of the bay. And so we hope that you are successful in that endeavor. But also this for those of you who are new board members, the board sponsored what was really the cutting edge of watershed teams. Collison et al. Is what it's termed here. That's the web address. This said cumulative effects in these watersheds are advanced, and that if we do not correct these conditions by the time that the ocean and climate cycle switch, which is 2015 to 2025, we're going to lose fish stocks. So I'm saying support your staff decisions based on more than a decade of science, and I was not up to speed on Tier 2. But that's generally good guidance.
Thank you. Jeanette Jungers, followed by Teresa Lucchesi.
I'm going to cede my space to Christy Wrigley.
I'll speak later. She will speak, and she'll have her own time then. Thank you. Teresa?
Well, I was going to go instead of Jeanette. You're not allowing that?
The chair's in charge. If she's ceding her time, that's all I need to know. Thank you.
I'm giving my time to Christy. So, yeah. That's okay, Jeanette.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jeanette Jungers. I'm a local school teacher and a resident of Humboldt County. I've been following these issues for the past 20 years. As a public trust agency, it's your responsibility to protect the waters in California for the residents' beneficial uses. Freshwater and elk residents have seen an 80% logging, which has resulted in sedimentation of elk and freshwater, causing flooding, property damage to many landowners. I believe you should rescind the Tier 2 THPs. There's no basis scientifically for those to exist. after reading all of the information, I am really appalled that they are allowed to continue to log in both freshwater and elk. This morning I saw three loaded trucks, double trucks, full of logs coming out of the Elk River. In an area where that degradation has happened, I believe that we need to see recovery, and we're never going to see recovery of these watersheds unless we can stop the damage. And the damage is caused by timber harvest activities. And so I believe that in order for the freshwater and Elk River residents to stop the degradation of their watersheds and the pain and loss of their property rights, it's going to need your action on your part. I've been following the board, and I've been taking time off work and coming in and speaking and writing letters for years. I would like to see you all do your jobs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Teresa, followed by Joyce King.
My name is Teresa Lucchese Cook, and I live in Freshwater. My family and I own a home, and to get to our house, our road crosses the flood zone on Freshwater Creek. It used to flood about once every 3 years. My neighbors have told me. I've been there since 1996. But since 1996, our road floods repeatedly, often more than 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times a year. We've seen a dramatic increase in the turbidity, the volatility of the creek, how fast it goes up and down, and the numbers of floods. And this time period is directly coinciding with PL's increase of logging operations. My family and I have been saying this to the CDF, Fish and Game, Board of Forestry, you name it, all of you, for years now. I testified with my infant son on my hip. He's now 12 years old. My daughter's now in high school, and she's come before you to say the same things again and again. So we always appreciate your time, but we wish something would happen. My kids have brought up to know that they should be afraid when it rains, because we're either going to get flooded in or out. They know that PL basically gets whatever they want to, in spite of consistent intentional bad behavior. They have learned that agencies that are supposed to police PL don't do that very well, and that PL ignores challenges, refuses, appeals, or delays compliance with rulings and continues to cut in spite of hundreds of violations. My kids know that PL claims a legal right to lie to regulators in the permitting process, and they use their science team to defend high rates of cut. My kids have gotten a close-up and personal view of what it looks like for a large corporation to exploit resources at the expense of even their own employees, and to see what happens when a corporation can insert itself into the political process. Water quality may be the only agency which understands the necessity of good forest management to sustain fresh water reserves. This board has had a lot of turnover in the last many years, and PL is counting on you to not remember how bad that they have been or how beautiful our creek used to be. There are logging trucks on Freshwater Road right now. I passed several on my way out here on Freshwater Road. Every request, petition, lawsuit from the residents of Freshwater, which has been denied, weakened, or lost, has later proven to have been the right thing to do. So I'm just wondering, how can you keep letting them cut? Freshwater Creek is basically fucked. THP should no longer be approved. Tier 2, whatever, it's time to stop. We're done. There is no reversal. Every indicator is going the wrong way. We have 6 feet of sediment in the bottom of the creek where there used to be clear stones. My kids are lucky if they ever see a fish. And my kids also know that they'll be very lucky if their grandkids ever see the creek to be healthy. It's really messed up.
Thank you. Joyce King, followed by Christy Riggler.
I'm sorry, I don't have copies for everyone. I can share. Thanks. Hi, I'm Joyce King. I've been a volunteer with
Salmon Forever, which has been monitoring in Freshwater Creek since about 1997, 10 years. And I have put together, I'm sorry, my things look so primitive. I'll try to come back sometime after I learn how to do a PowerPoint. Those PowerPoints are so beautiful. But I've given you a graph that I made using data from Pacific Watershed Associates sediment source inventory of Freshwater Creek, water quality data, and some data from California Department of Forestry. And I do have some maps, which I couldn't make color copies of for everybody, but I can leave one set. Basically, what I'd like you to concentrate on in this harvest rate graph is the cycles of logging since 1860 with the large increases in 1930 and 1970. Both of those times, historic records and actual some film footage of Freshwater Creek residents, they talk about the flooding that followed those increases in 1930 and 1970. And not long after the 1970 cycle, there was a little downturn in logging, but a huge upturn again in 1986. I think that was at about the time of the takeover of the Pacific Lumber Company. So the last three bars are what I'd like you to concentrate on in this graph. The rate and extent of logging that has taken place since 1986 is unprecedented. The maps in the packet that show basically what has happened during that last cycle from 1986 to I just have from 2004 or 2006. Those two maps are not too different. But the residents started noticing changes in their creek and in flooding back here in 1990, in this first map, where this new cycle of logging started. Then we can proceed through the other maps, and each one is connected with an event in the narrative that I also gave you.
And Joyce, I'll ask you to conclude.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Do you have an additional comment to finish up? But
well, I think that if you look at the packet, it should be self-explanatory.
But all right.
Thank you.
Christy Wrigley, followed by Jesse Noel.
Jean should have given you a handout, did she?
I do not believe so.
I asked her if it's over there. Can we please get that handout to them?
Yes.
Do you want me to hand it out? Thank you. Morris, let's hold that up. My name is Christy Wrigley. I live in Elk River. I've been addressing this board for over a decade. It's clear from my position that you intend to authorize a nuisance, to diminish our property rights, our riparian water rights, and to increase the risk to our health and safety. You could have chosen a zero sediment discharge on all logging, and I mean a real zero, as you have done in other cases, not this particular board, but other boards. Instead, you chose to grandfather in 100 acres of clear-cut logging, chose to disconnect the cleanup and abatement orders, which are so critical to the welfare of our environment and those of us living below it. And you chose to increase the limit from a 10-year to a 20-year recovery period, so-called definition of recovery, not real recovery for those of us that know that river and depend on it for both domestic and agriculture, and our entire lives depend on it. And no less, you added a so-called zero sediment discharge, which at the time it was spoken, we understood that zero was zero, but it later turned out that zero didn't really mean zero. All of this to enable the upstream landowner to maximize their logging. All of this is the same thing that CDF has done. Define the problem away and answer it with words on paper. The results are clear if you look at the second picture, and it shows exactly how much sedimentation is going on. We experience all the sediment, not just that, from shallow landslides within a logging plan. Every piece of sediment, whether it's natural or caused by logging, affects our lives, not just our water quality, but our property rights. We're turning our land into a wetlands. I should hope that you could do better. I know you can, but we can't do it without you. Thank you, and it's been 10 years, and I've never had more than 5 minutes, and you've never asked me a single question, and I'll bet I know more about Elk River than everybody in this room. Thank you.
Can I ask one question? I'll break the cycle.
I'd be honored.
Tell me about that log jam. Is it still there? If it isn't, do you know the status of the logs?
And I don't know what you mean by that log jam. There are many.
Okay, thank you.
If you mean the one that is at the beer gate on my property, it is there and growing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Jesse Noel, followed by Ken Miller.
Thank you, members of the board, and welcome Mr. Hales to the board. My name is Jesse Noel. I live in the South Fork of Elk River in a 104-year-old farmhouse, and we are subjected to frequent flooding that exceeds the FEMA 100-year flood line, and it causes our septic system to malfunction. I'm sure it violates the basin plan. I've read your basin plan standard. The WDR authorizes the flood height, the peak flow runoff flood affected height, to increase in upstream of us. And I'm here today to bring forward something that I'm sure your bank of attorneys has already fully briefed you on, and that is the obstruction of the river channel bed. You are probably aware that Elk River is a navigable river in the nuisance flood reaches. If you're not, I can vouch that I frequently kayaked it, and it's just like the canoeists of old, the trappers, it's still, you still can enjoy it in that way. And as such, the state holds in trust, owns the bed of the river upon which 6, 4, 6, 8, 9 feet of sediment are obstructing the river bed. And I'm sure that your, or I hope that your bank of attorneys have informed you of Monterey versus Areola, where the Supreme Court of California affirmed that when the state obstructs or authorizes the obstruction of the, of a channel, and it backs up water and causes the water to divert onto private property, that is a taking. There's no reasonable use standard that applies. Now, I know that your board weighed the benefit to the our upstream neighbor against the harm to my community and decided that it was worth it to harm us in order to provide economic benefit to the community, and I guess in the form of tax revenue and jobs. And yes, the government under our Constitution can do that, and it's called eminent domain, and there's required to be notification and just compensation when the government chooses to do that. But here, you've chosen not to do that. You've chosen to extort, under a pretext, our property from us. And it is very well laid out. There are hundreds of properties affected. The statute of limitations doesn't begin to run until for takings of a physical invasion or regulatory takings like this by inverse condemnation, until the effect, the impact, has stabilized. Well, it hasn't stabilized. The staff plate that Salmon Forever put in at my farmhouse in 2000 has now upgraded to 2.2 or 2.3 feet. It continues. You have photographs from each time we've spoken of how rapidly it is degrading. So I, you know, urge this board to, number one, look at 40 CFR 131.12, the anti-degradation clause, and immediately cause this river to recover as soon as possible to the Clean Water Act anti-degradation standard. I ask you to look at State Water Board 6816, which is what you're supposed to be making decisions based upon. And I ask you to look at the statute 3479, which is the nuisance statute, and also Nestle versus City of Santa Monica, for, you know, to see whether or not you're authorized to subject us to a nuisance and escape from compensation, just compensation.
Jesse, I ask you to conclude.
Okay, fair enough.
If you have an additional comment.
I also, for the new board member, I'm one of the people who appealed the WDR, and we will bring that forward on appeal. I think we've discovered enough evidence to demonstrate how well your policy, your comprehensive, deliberate, calculated regulatory policy is working. And so we hope, we continue to hope that government will work out these problems. It's been 10 years. We believe that it's constitutionally unfair to burden us in order to benefit another party. In other words, to single us out to bear a burden that society as a whole should bear. We're not saying that you can't destroy, authorize the destruction of Elk River, but we're saying that you have to follow the Constitution when you do so.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ken Miller, followed by Kate Sullivan.
Thank you. My name is Ken Miller, and I'm a part of Salmon Forever and have been a part of monitoring for many years. I've been watching this since 1990. I finally gave up on coming to this board because it was so frustrating. I've been watching the bias, the obfuscation for a long time. In response to John Corbett's question about settlement, I want to point out that PWA back in 99 said that harvest-related landslides, road-related landslides, and road surface are all the same, John. There's no difference. They're all around 75,000 yards. But I bring that up because John's questions so far have always gone away from the issue. What about the logjam? What about Jupiter's position in the sky? That's what we get. The only time there's ever been a recovery is when there was a moratorium. I suggest to the new board member and the rest of the board members that you look back at the moratorium that was instituted, I think it was something like 99 to 2001. There was recovery. Why was there recovery? Well, Mark pointed out one of the central premises about landslides, but the real central premise that you developed and was sort of the gold standard, and that was in the sediment budget that was developed by your staff with Redwood Sciences. At the core of that was that canopy removal produces an increase in peak flow in sediment, just canopy removal. And why this is so brilliant is because it gets away from the confusion of which kind of silviculture we're dealing with. Is it a clear cut? Is it a selection? Is it this or that? You take away some canopy, you can quantify the discharges. And that's the central premise. I also have to, you know, this obfuscation, this bias, this board, it was illustrated to me most poignantly when we went to Freshwater. The board went to Freshwater. We went to Cleet Isbell's house, which is a beautiful house right on Freshwater Creek. I was in the car with Mr. Massey. Mr. Massey turned to me after we had visited this beautiful house, and he said to me, "Why should we be protecting somebody like this? Because he's so wealthy, because it's such a beautiful house." I said to him, "Well, you think Hurwitz is poor? So you guys are protecting this company." Again, for the new board members and perhaps the old, this is a company whose every submission needs to be suspect. Why? Well, in 95, a federal court found that they had fraudulently submitted Marvin Millett surveys, kept the duplicates in their closet. It was a double set of books. They changed it. The judge said this company will do anything to get the cutout, anything. They deceived all the regulators, and they violated the ESA, and it cost them $1.2 million. Then when they lost their timber license, you know what CDF said? They intentionally deceived CDF in Freshwater. Intentionally. Yeah, I see it. I'll stop in just a second. After the HCP came the Mass Wasting Science Panel. PL dropped it because it showed what water quality knew all along. Your board said that this HCP will not protect water quality. Obviously, it's about time. There's no more company. They've lived up to their promises to go bankrupt by 2007. So you don't even have that anymore. So there's no reason now to keep capitulating to intimidation and bias. Thank you.
Thank you. Kate Sullivan?
Dr. Sullivan, I believe.
All right, go on to Mike Miles.
First handout I'm giving you is a sample Tier 2 submittal. The second handout is the record on Tier 2 and on our harvest in the last couple of years in the WWDR.
My name is Mike Miles, and I represent the Pacific Lumber Company. I'm a resource manager. Dr. Sullivan was going to speak with you on behalf of the Tier 2 process, what goes into it. It is quite a robust landslide screening effort. And she was also going to talk about the monitoring results. To date, there are no landslides from either Tier 1 or Tier 2, any of the WWDR harvest units. So that's the record there, and we have plenty of monitoring reporting that we submit to your staff that will demonstrate that record. This is an old argument that I'm hearing today. It's the argument that brought us to where we're at today, which is a curtailed timber harvest ability. CDF set a limitation. The Water Board heard from concerned citizens, and they set new WWDRs, which further curtailed our activities. And we've obliged or complied with those new limitations. So you adopted resolutions that set forth harvest allowances in the form of acres limitations and monitoring and reporting requirements. And that was the order. And on page one of the smaller handout that I gave you, that's the Tier 2 order. That's at the heart of it. All it says is, Palka, you come with your best science. You do timber harvest plans that don't cause landslides. And if you have one landslide out of those units, you're done. It's over. It's back to just Tier 1. And so we're obliged by that. Since that time, staff has asked that we also provide more of a screening process, that we show what we do, what is our best science, and how do we know where to avoid landslides. It's a crazy argument to say landslides just happen and they're unpredictable. They don't happen on flat ground. So it's odd to say that. And so there are shades of high hazard, low hazard, medium hazard, zero hazard, and we can have that discussion, and all that is part of the screening process and the Tier 2 enrollments. So in any case, staff has asked for us to provide additional information when we do an enrollment. It does take more of staff's time. It puts the burden on them as well as us to do that information. And it also changed Tier 2 from a performance standard, if there's a landslide, you stop, to a time-intensive, on part of water quality staff, review process where they have to look at each one and decide whether or not it may or may not have a landslide. So, and then they get to decide whether or not our submittal is accepted. On page two of what I handed you, there's an Excel spreadsheet, and that shows to date these WWRs. On the far left, for example, if you'll turn to that, and I'll try to keep this quick, in 2006, the WWDR order allowed a certain amount of acres for each one of the watersheds, some Tier 1, some Tier 2. The 2006 harvest plan is what the Pacific Lumber Company submitted under Tier 1 and Tier 2, and the total acres on the right. The actual, on the further right, harvest permitted is what was enrolled by your staff. We got all the Tier 1 acres, and we got 54% of the Tier 2 acres. Combined, we got 73% of what was allowed under the order that you adopted and issued in 2006. Take us to 2007, same thing. We get all the Tier 1s, we get 38% of the Tier 2, and so altogether we get 62% of what was allowed under the order. So now, in 2008, staff is recommending additional changes, including public notice periods and a timeline for the enrollment procedure. And if these are adopted, if such changes are reviewed and adopted by this board, we hope that they also include a self-imposed time limit by staff so that we know before November or December which units we're going to get to log and which units we will not get to log. And so I'll just end that I look forward to continuing to work with staff. I take some offense at the citizenry here that's here today telling me that we're not taking our obligation as professionals serious. We do. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Cletus Isbell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm Cletus Isbell. I'm a freshwater resident. I'm here, as I have been many times in the last 10 years, to tell you that the excessive logging sediment from Palko is continuing to discharge into Freshwater Creek and is resulting in damage to my property, threatening my home, and has decreased its market value. I'm being buried in silt and inundated with floodwaters. Palko implies that they enjoy some special status because of the Headwaters Agreement, but this is false. Your staff's report of September 2000 makes it clear that the HCP Implementation Agreement, and this is the actual agreement that was signed by Palko and the agencies, requires that Palko still comply with all applicable federal and state laws and regulations. This includes, among others, Porter Cologne. And Porter Cologne specifically states, and I quote, "All discharges of waste into waters of the state are privileges, not rights." On the other hand, I am entitled to full relief and protection as provided by the California water quality laws and regulations from the sediment and flooding harm being inflicted on me due to the continuing cumulative effects of Palco's logging operations. I have a lawful right to this protection, and it is this board's responsibility to provide it. Therefore, I request that you begin to meet your responsibilities by first, immediately revoke Palco's Tier 2 MRP and allow no enrollments in 2008 and beyond. It's time to end this unbelievable charade of so-called zero sediment logging operations. And second, immediately make further enrollments for the privilege of discharging sediment waste under the WWDRs contingent on being compliant and up to date with all current and past requirements, including CAOs. Don't grant Palco the privilege of discharging your sediment if they haven't met their obligations under their cleanup and abatement orders. There's no need for more study. There is a need for action. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That concludes the request I have on this. I've got one more possible public comment, but I wanted to this issue put a wrap on it in terms of if there are, again, it's a public forum item. We've certainly been engaged on this issue heretofore, and you know, we don't have any action in front of us, but before leaving it, I'll hear from our executive officer. Any comment?
Well, just that we appreciate the comments. We've heard them. I've taken extensive notes, and we'll take them under consideration in looking at the monitoring reporting program.
Mr. Corbett?
Yes, one thought I have is I hope nothing here delays the TMDL process, because that's a comprehensive look and review of these problems, and I believe that's on schedule. I did want to indicate to Palco under the permit the burden always is with the discharger. I did want to indicate in regard to cleanup and abatement, we've had a difficult enforcement road. We referred that to the state enforcement staff, and there's still an additional difficulty they've had moving forward. I won't go into it here, but I tried to analyze about 50 or 60 years of California law in prior hearings, why that was, that we would need additional regulatory approaches than that, and I believe our difficulties reflect that. The original permit dealt primarily with terms and conditions of harvest. I do believe roads and legacy roads are a logical component to be reviewed in the future in the TMDL process, and similarly, a restoration plan should be reviewed as warranted. Then one piece of advice to the residents, I don't speak for the county, but my sense is that they're very fearful of any road improvements could result in liability and litigation, and that's something I can't communicate to them, but I think that's going to be part of the problem. And then to staff, I thought it would be really good to check the moratorium data against the model predictions, because I think we actually here have some data, although I do want to say in the record there was some criticism of whether you can apply that the model works best the smaller the size of the watershed and worse the larger, but I think that's a valid point to look at.
Anybody else? I guess I would just end with, you know, the board, staff is aware. The board has an interest in this, and if there's information that we should be reviewing as to how things are working, progressing, I think the board welcomes hearing that at the appropriate time. I think also staff should know that the board is also sensitive to the fact that this is a long-fought, hard issue, and there are things that we're not interested in hearing again. So, you know, I guess some balance between what we need to know and protecting us from having old debates. So, you know, scheduling an item may send us down the path towards an old debate, but if there's new information, I guess we should be apprised as to how well the program's working. So.
Will do.
All right. With that, contrary to all other things I say, but Michelle, if you want to speak on the excess sediment item, accommodate your schedule just so that, because I'm such a good kid, you know.